Welcome to Crown and Crozier, the podcast on church, state, and faithful citizenship. I'm your host, Patrick Brown. It's not every day that the successor of St. Peter makes a trip to your home and native land. In anticipation of Pope Francis' visit to Canada, we focus this episode on the broader context of the Holy Father's visit, major themes and challenges associated with Francis's 9-year-long pontificate, reconciliation with Indigenous peoples, and whether Canada has a unique contribution to make to the mission of the Universal Church in the 21st century. Along the way, we take a couple of scenic detours, including reminiscing about the last time a Pope visited Canada for the occasion of World Youth Day in 2002, and reminding ourselves of the ultimate importance of continuously building communities of faith, whether it's in your local neighborhood, in an institution of higher learning, or even in an online platform. Our guest for this episode is John Paul Meenan, Assistant Professor of Theology at Seat of Wisdom College in Barry's Bay, Ontario. John Paul was the co-founder of the small academic community, which eventually grew and flourished to become Seat of Wisdom College. He's also the editor-in-chief of the online magazine, Catholic Insight. We'd be very grateful if you do us the favor of following us on social media, leaving us a rating on Apple or Spotify, subscribing wherever you get your podcasts, or supporting the show. Visit www.crownandcrozier.com for more information.
There are two swords, and the question is, which sword is superior, the spiritual sword or the temporal sword?
And without God, democracy will not and cannot long endure.
I die His Majesty's good servant, at God's first.
Welcome to another episode of Crown and Crozier. We're delighted to welcome our guest, John Paul Meenan. John Paul, great to have you with us.
Thank you, Patrick. It's good to be here.
I'm going to start with what admittedly is a bit of a trite question, but we're going to anchor a lot of our conversation in this particular topic and take things from there. But as the whole world knows, the Pope is coming to Canada, and John Paul Meenan, when you hear that Pope Francis is making an apostolic visit to Canada, what do you think? What comes to mind?
Well, it's certainly a momentous and historical occasion. It's a bit of a surprise, given his age and the recent reports about his health, the pain in his knee, and other. Usually they don't disclose too much about a Pope's medical diagnoses, but he's canceled other trips. Now, albeit those other trips like to Africa would be much more arduous in some ways than a trip to Canada, like a first world country. So we're hoping he comes. I mean, the Pope is always the Pope. Obviously, Pope Francis is a little bit more of a controversial figure than, let's say, Pope John Paul II, who came to Canada back in 2002. And I recall that during the World Youth Days in Toronto. So there probably people have some mixed feelings about the Pope's visit in terms of the intentions and why he's coming. But at the end of the day, it is a joyful and historical thing that we should support and for which we should pray and give the Pope the respect and love and obedience that he is owed. So with that, I mean, there's obviously certain details about the trip and why he's coming to Canada that we could probably discuss in a few moments. But overall, I am happy and I look forward to his visit and maybe to catch a glimpse of him.
For members of the church, as you say, who have mixed feelings on the Pope, mixed feelings on the visit, perhaps have felt a little confused, a little hurt by some of the Pope's comments or areas of emphasis in his pontificate, what would you encourage them to keep in mind?
Well, the church is the church militant. I know people don't use that term much anymore, but it is embedded in the tradition. And in a military, the church is a journeying towards a trinity. Now, it's not a military organization, like an earthly one. Our battle is against spirits and principalities and powers, so to speak. And in the military, there's an old saying that we respect the office. We salute the office, not the man. So every pope brings his human imperfections to the office, some more than others. And we, some traditional Catholics, conservative on the conservative side, may disagree with some of the pope's emphases and some things that he says. But as I said just a few minutes ago, he's still the Pope. So we respect the office, and the Pope making a visit is still the vicar, as Catherine of Siena called him, the sweet vicar of Christ on earth. We take that emphasis, I would say. And then the second thing is that even with the human qualities and that Pope Francis brings to the office, there are good ones. Like, there's many good aspects to Pope Francis' pontificate that in public, I like to emphasize and to support. Obviously, I write sometimes with a little bit of criticism of some of his policies and some of his decisions and what he's done. But we should, as the saying goes, emphasize the positive. And while, like, the negative things, yeah, they're there. And I'd like to speak a bit about them, perhaps. But I would say keep upbeat. And the Christ, it's really Christ's church. No matter what the Pope does or decides to do or not do, Christ is guiding all things. And the visit, I think, will produce good fruit if we pray and we unpack what happens in the next few weeks, next few days with the visit itself, and then in the weeks and months that follow upon that, we're hoping that good and good fruit will be born.
It certainly had been my intention to pick your brain on what kind of fruit we can hope and pray will be yielded from this visit. Anything specific perhaps that you have in your mind or your heart and which might be a focus of your prayers in terms of the fruits and graces that might flow from this visit?
Well, clearly the primary, that's why I alluded a few moments ago, the primary purpose of the visit is, as far as I can read, is to offer another more formal apology for the residential school, difficulties in the residential school system, and that flow from that, the abuses, the purported accounts of colonialism and the imposition of a cultural way of life and religion that perhaps was done in ways that were less than felicitous. So with that, that requires that we unpack that and distinguish. So let's look at the negative aspect side of that. In any sort of apology, like an apologia, there is, St. Peter says, it's a reasoned defense. That's what an apologia really is. In English, it comes to mean, you know, that we make reparation and for what has been done wrong. Now, those two things kind of coalesce, and they're not separate, they're distinct. So what I hope happens is that we can focus on what was done imperfectly, but yet also bring to light what was done well. And in the history of Catholicism in Canada, which I'd like to look at, many more things were done well than badly. And the intentions were certainly good in the beginning, but anything that's put into practice can be done less than perfectly. So what I hope the Pope does is offer to the Indigenous people, especially when he goes out west to Edmonton and Alberta, and then also his visit to Quebec, that he offers more an apologia than yet another just simple apology. So apologies have been given, Pope Benedict XVI in 2009 and JP2 in the Jubilee year in a more general way, and all the way back to 1991. So we hope that things can be clarified. So as we journey forward in the Catholic Church in Canada with the Indigenous and also all the other immigrants and others who come to this fair land, that we can make those proper distinctions and live, you know, more in harmony in the truth. So the ultimate purpose of this is to find the truth. And that truth is found primarily in the Catholic Church, offering the truth to people that will perfect and elevate any culture.
Trying to take the upbeat point of view, as you say, acknowledging that this visit marks an opportunity for the head of the church to offer an apology directly to Indigenous peoples on Canadian soil, and in some instances on the traditional lands of Indigenous peoples who were directly affected by the residential schools and their legacy. It does offer an opportunity, for lack of a better term, for closure as it relates to acknowledging past wrongs and then moving forward. As you just indicated, this apology will come on the heels of previous statements of sorrow and remorse and apology by prior popes, but also by all of the parties who were involved in the residential schools themselves. I mean, there's an argument that the more meaningful apologies have already come because they came from the communities, from the diocese, from the archbishops, from the priests who were directly involved in the residential schools and their abuses and their legacies. But this is a direct apology by the head of the church on Canadian soil. In terms of what comes next, what is an ideal next or first step?
Clearly, you'd want continued evangelization and conversion. So the church is there from the very beginning to evangelize and to that metanoia, as Christ says, repent and believe the gospel. The gospel message, the good news, has gone forth in the world from the very beginning of the church, and even in some ways in the Old Testament in embryonic potential form, or at least in its Old Testament Judaic form, and then the perfection of that in Christianity by Christ himself, God made man. So what we hope happens and what should happen is the continued advance of the Catholic Church. Now, what does that mean? The church is a hierarchical institution. There is this institution called the Catholic Church. But at a deeper level, it is the mystical body of Christ. And as the mystical body of Christ, the church exists in incarnate form in every culture. And the purpose of the church is not to abolish cultures, not to remove them. That was the bad side, perhaps, of colonialism, is this crushing of the genius, as John Paul II called it, of native cultures, not just in Canada, but America, Australia, Russia, whatever you want, Ukraine, across Europe.
South America,
very certainly that's one of the, very much in the news nowadays, the Amazon, where you take everything that is good in a culture, and every culture is something to teach us. And so there's a mutual perfection between the church and the cultures to which the church is introduced and those who bring the truth, because the truth always sets us free. So obviously in any sort of quote unquote pagan practice, now that's obviously a loaded term, and all that means goes back to the Roman days is those who we're going to call the pre-Christian civilization. So pre-Christian civilizations have their own perfection, but they're also imperfect in some ways, right? So they're lacking something. And what the church should bring is to bring them to perfection. So even my own Irish lineage and Scottish, obviously when St. Patrick brought the faith to Ireland, there was paganism, the Druidism. Now there was goodness there, but also much that was wrong. And that was brought again to what was good was brought to greater perfection, and what was not good or wrong could be slowly removed. So when the early missionaries came here back at the 1600s, the Jesuits were very aware of that. So John de Brébeuf and others were profound anthropologists. And John de Brébeuf could take, if you read his life, and there was a great sensitivity to the indigenous culture in Huronia and Iroquois and the Ottawans. And he would wrote dictionaries with their own language, hymns in their language, and they loved him. That's what I think should happen in our own modern era. Hopefully, there is a true reconciliation. What we don't want is a regression, like back to the, to say that the pre-Christian way of life was just good in and of itself. That's not going to work. We have to be honest about that. And the church has to be clear that we can't go back, but we have to go forward. Hopefully, all details of that are certainly, that gets in, the more you get into the details, the more controversial it might get. Like how does liturgy work? How do we celebrate Mass and integrate, whatever genius of the cultures are there in terms of liturgy and then education.
That's all very beautiful in and of itself, and it dovetails and converges with other themes and other conversations we've had on this program. Speaking about the legacy of saints like Saint Jean de Brébeuf and Bartolomos de las Casas, these missionaries to pre-Christian indigenous cultures and who demonstrated that sensitivity as part of their evangelization. On a related point, it's a prayer of mine that the church in Canada renews its confidence in that objective. I've remarked before, even last year, when there was a reiteration, a formal statement of apology from the bishops' conference, what was missing was some kind of recognition that ultimately, at the end of the day, we still wish for salvation for our Indigenous brothers and sisters, and that our Lord is the source of all mercy. And there almost seems to be a bit of a reticence for members of the church, whether laity or clergy, in Canada to speak that type of language. In light of all the legacy and the abuses from residential schools, we almost pull back. We don't use the language of evangelization when we're talking about our relationship with Indigenous peoples. And if a fruit from this visit can be a renewed confidence in that type of posture, then I think this visit would have been a great success.
Well, you're right about that. I mean, one of the common words used in the Acts of the Apostles is parhesia. It's a Greek word. It's hard to translate into English. Sometimes it's translated as boldness, courage, confidence. It encompasses many aspects, but it refers to the apostles after Pentecost. So before Pentecost, they were, you know, in the locked room, fearful. And after we went forth boldly, even to martyrdom. And the only way we can have confidence, which literally is confide, like it is strength in faith, is to be grounded in our faith. And the faith really is grounded in truth. So what is the truth? Well, the truth, again, encompasses the many aspects of what we would call culture. And there is a requisite for salvation. Pope Benedict promulgated this, the Regensburg Address back, you know, recall that, in the early days of his pontificate. There he said that the church is an historical entity, and that the truth is embedded in the historical journey of the church through the millennia. And that includes like all the Roman and Greek civilization, but also encompassing all the other civilizations that the church has come in contact with. And in this body of what we call revelation, and revelation not just from what Christ has given us, but how it's been unpacked through the ages. And so that whole body of truth is what we offer. And then along with the truth is all the system of liturgy, sacraments, prayer. And that confidence in what we have is I agree wholeheartedly. And that's the beauty of Catholicism.
There's one comment that you made in the last couple minutes, and I can't resist. I want to circle back on it. You had mentioned, if circumstances allowed, you would love to go catch a glimpse of the Holy Father when he comes to Canada. I was actually having a conversation with our 12-year-old daughter and my wife the other day, and my daughter raised that exact topic. Oh, it's too bad the Holy Father's not coming to Ottawa. We're not going to be able to see him. And I'll be honest, it was a really difficult conversation because I said to her, and we're not sure if he came to Ottawa, if we would actually go see him, because our feelings are so mixed. And as it relates to the nature of this pontificate and what by many objective measures, one would argue has been a greater confusion, a greater division within the church, setting aside the church's relationship with modernity and the secular world. And arguably the confusion and division, which has been exacerbated by certain actions on the part of the Holy Father. And I have to admit, I never in my adult life would have contemplated being in a position where I was having that conversation with my own child about the prospect of the Holy Father coming to our country, potentially to our own backyard in our own city, and not feeling moved or inspired or even just having these conflicted feelings about whether to go see him. But I'm curious, just to get your response, I'm sure there are probably many people in your circle who might share that view. And how would you respond to that?
Well, yeah, I see that. And I know one of my former students who took down all the pictures of Pope Francis in his house. I thought, okay, there's two ways to look at that, right? And obviously, that's why I made the contrast between going to see JP2, 2002, and then possibly going to see Pope Francis this time. I'm not sure I will. It just came up today, as a matter of fact, because I was thinking of making a pilgrimage to Quebec City, just out of the blue, and only came up the other day in conversation with a board member of Catholic Insight that the Pope's going to be in Quebec. I didn't really know that. And I thought, oh, would I go? And I felt sort of like you. My feelings are ambivalent. And I would not go for the same reasons as I would go to see John Paul II, whom I saw twice, once in Rome and once in Toronto. And I remember just being so enthused. Now, I was younger then, and I thought it was just this exuberance of just going to see. So here's one thing I would just mention, that our faith isn't really about feelings. When I journey, I try to go on journeys for pilgrimage reasons. So I would go, if I did go see the Pope, it would be partly to go to Quebec City, partly to pray for Canada. But again, it goes back to what I said at the beginning of our conversation, which is he's still the Pope. Now, obviously, some people dispute that. I still think, okay, he's the Pope. He does carry the office. And even if I felt ambivalent or even antipathetic about it, like I do have grave reservations about things that he has done and aspects of his papacy. And I can see it clearly, you know, some of the things that it's going to be, it'll take a long time to undo some of the damage that's been done. That honestly, whether wittingly or not, I'm not sure what his mind is or whatever. Yeah, so there are going to be repercussions of what. But even if I could just go pray for him and pray for the church, it would be something I could do. Now, again, you're a dad, you have kid children. It would be different dragging children and going on a big pilgrimage. And it would be something more spiritual for me. But I agree with you. There would be mixed feelings. Yeah. I can't even imagine how I would feel seeing Pope Francis.
Well, I mean, one thing, I mean, just for the benefit of our listeners, to provide a little bit of context, I mean, in terms of specifics, which form the basis for my ambivalence, as you would say, going back to some of the synods that have been held, the synod on the family, the synod on Amazonia, and not just what was necessarily on the table for those synods, but things that emerged in terms of, I mean, clear indicators that there were forces afoot seeking changes in church doctrine. And not only were these being tolerated by the Vatican, but it seemed like they were being actively encouraged, particularly as it relates to church's longstanding teaching on ordination of women, church's teaching on sexuality. The scandal that occurred on the margins of the Amazon Synod with the what seemed to be a worship service for pagan gods, the Pachamama, and what's been going on in Germany with respect to the Synodal Way and what seems to be either a tacit or an overt support from the Vatican for that particular process, and the flirtation with the pursuit of major fundamental changes to tradition and teaching, particularly as it relates to human sexuality and anthropology. And I'll just be honest with you, John Paul, I feel like the record of the Holy Father as it relates to the traditional liturgy, I don't think he likes the liturgy. And on some days, depending on what he says, I don't think he likes the people who like the liturgy. I mean, I felt myself saying, I'm just not sure the Holy Father likes me, because he seems to think I'm rigidly attached to some antiquated form of liturgical worship. Again, for your benefit and for the benefit of listeners, it's just providing some context on those remarks.
Yeah, everything you said, I agree with. I have the same reservations. Now, the Pope has not, I've read almost everything he's written. I mean, at least the major things. And he's never promulgated heresy per se, although things he's done and said are propaedeutic to certainly undermining aspects of the faith, which is very odd and disconcerting for a Catholic.
And pardon to interrupt, I mean, there was that Wednesday audience he gave a couple of months ago in Rome, and it seemed like statements were being made around apostates being members of the communion of saints. And that's another example I would cite.
What the Pope does, he, whatever his interior state, and whatever mission, whatever his intentions, he certainly is forcing Catholics to think. Like, he's pushing the notion of papal power and authority to its limits. And so even in many blogs and articles, forcing people, whatever, to think, how far can the Pope go? And what is the papacy? And how does, and even in terms of the moral law, who belongs to the church, what does salvation mean? So even indirectly, yeah, I agree, this is all sort of very problematical and difficult. But at the end of the day, there could be good fruit from it. It's revealing people's interior hearts and where our faith and our loyalties reside, and sharpening our minds and our grasp of the faith and the principles thereof, and to say, well, how do we unpack this? So yeah, that's why I would say, okay, he's there, he's given to us, what do we do? How do we respond to it? The two extremes, you know, obviously just completely ignoring the Pope and just whitewashing ourselves of him, that would be one way, but I don't think that would be all that helpful, because the church can't really exist without a Pope in some ways. And then also some sort of obeisance that just is also not a very helpful way to approach any papacy, good or bad. So I think that making the distinctions is a good thing. And whether I end up seeing them or not, I'm not, I'll certainly, we should all pray and pray for whatever quote unquote conversion he needs and strength, peace, goodwill.
Well, if nothing else, I mean, certainly something I've spoken about a lot with my wife, family, friends. It is important to bear in mind a historical perspective. And more recently, you could say we've been spoiled or we became acclimated to popes such as Benedict XVI and John Paul II. And right now, the pontificate of Francis has conjured up some echoes of previous pontificates dating back well into church history where there were real challenges. We had the Avignon papacy. We had other moments in church history where the tone at the top or the actions at the top had challenges. And it just so happens that we're living in a point in time where we're seeing that on display, and we're some of us are experiencing that for the first time. But it's not the first time in the history of the church. And I do have to remind myself and others, that's an important fact.
It's funny you mentioned that, because I'm just reading right now, preparation for a course, possibly, this History of the Popes by Eamon Duffy. Mm. So it's a recent book, relatively recent, 2006, whatever. And he's famous for his History of the Protestant Reformation, Stripping of the Altars, which was a very influential book, quite well done. And this does give you a historical perspective of the papacies wax and wane. And it's good to keep the church in historical perspective. It is the bark of Peter, and it tilts, it jolts. There is the storms. There are the storms. There are the winds and tempests, and sometimes it goes off course. But as I said before, Christ is the ultimate pilot and leading us in the right direction. And I said, it is more I think about it, more I think we have to pray for our popes, our bishops, our priests, good, bad, indifferent, whatever. Support them where they're good, and then criticize them in charity and goodwill when they're obviously going a little bit off the rails, or a lot off the rails, as the case may be.
Well, one thing I want to make sure to cover with you, just a brief scenic detour down memory lane, your memories of the prior papal visit. It just so happens in Canada's history, the only papal visits we've had were from John Paul II. The cross-country extravaganza in 1984, the brief return trip to the Northwest Territories, a visit to a primarily indigenous community that John Paul II had originally intended to visit in 1984, but was prevented due to bad weather. So he made good on his promise 3 years later to come visit those folks. That was 1987. And then in 2002 for World Youth Day in Toronto. And you mentioned World Youth Day in Toronto. I had the good fortune to participate in that event fulsomely and to be touched by it, to be moved. I'd like to think to have been the recipient of some real grace. But let's just go down memory lane for a moment. Your memories of World Youth Day in Toronto and perhaps how those are maybe something you're reflecting on a little bit more in the lead up to this impending visit.
Certainly, there's a reason why God gave us popes, right? They are charismatic figures in a sense. Like the word charism means, you know, a gift given by God to bring others to salvation. A gratia gratis data, as they says in Latin, a gift freely given. Now, they don't necessarily make the holder of the charism holy, but they do bring people into the faith, so to speak, some way or another, whether it be from teaching or ministry or podcasting or whatever you might do, the gift you're given. And so the Pope is given this charism. Now, added to the external charism of the papacy itself, there is also the interior charism of the person. That's what we call people charismatic. Now, that means, and we can develop those by our own discipline, effort, education, sanctity, prayer. And JP2 was obviously an incredibly charismatic figure. He took the gifts God gave him and brought them to perfection. We need not belabor the fact he's a saint. So the gift given from having a saint visit our shores, our land, what do we say about that? It was momentous. Now, that said, I do have reservations, practically speaking, about World Youth Days, the liturgical aspect of them. I could wax eloquent about that for the next little while, but let's not focus on that aspect of it. But just to say that, yes, I happened to be there in 1984 and I saw JP2. I was basically a child or whatever, I didn't know much about it. I just kind of was dragged there by my parents, and there was JP2, and I didn't know anything really. Just there was the Pope. It was much more significant 2002, and I was aware much more of who he was. Yes, I think that the graces of that are still flowing in Canada. Now, people criticize that and say, well, where's the new springtime, the new evangelization? The church in Canada is crumbling. In some ways, it is. And there is a tragic dimension to the church in Canada. But there's also hope. Like you mentioned your own parish in Ottawa. I see many aspects of hope. I go to many weddings of my students and these young people who are keeping the faith and raising children and living lives of deep prayer and sacrifice. And it doesn't take much to produce the fire of faith, so to speak, in any nation. It just takes a few. I mean, the church started with 12. It can end with 12. Like there's no reason why it doesn't have to be big and momentous and in the news. And I think that JP2, in his visit in 2002, planted seeds. And that's what the church does. It plants seeds. And the seeds are primarily in people's hearts. They're not going to make the major media, but it's the question of the church is about individual salvation, something you mentioned a few moments ago. In one of his memoirs, JP2 was asked, are you worried about Islam overtaking Catholicism as the biggest religion in the world? And his response was, well, the church and salvation is not about statistics. It's about the salvation of individual souls. And his visit would be worth it if one soul was saved. And certainly, there's millions probably of souls saved and brought to the truth. So I think that, yeah, for all the difficulties and problems with World Youth Days and all the rigmarole, and yes, there's much that we could say about that could be brought to more, done more efficiently or more optimally. Ultimately, evangelization is, yeah, it's an imperfect and messy business, but But as G.K. Chesterton said, if something's worth doing, it's worth doing badly. Now, what does that mean? Does it mean you do it evilly, but it means you do it less than perfectly? And as long as you do your best, and I think JP2 did his best.
Well, it's interesting you say that. The one testimony, I suppose, that I would share with you as it relates to World Youth Day, I had the good fortune of attending two of them, 2000 in Rome, and then in my hometown 2 years later in Toronto. And I think the one thing I would leave for you, I had considered myself generally strong and well-formed in my faith. I do attribute what I would like to think is an ability to believe with my heart to graces and fruits of World Youth Day. I think before that, it was largely a trajectory of believing in the faith with my head. Post-World Youth Day, there was a real, okay, now I believe with my heart. And that may sound a little trite or fluffy or vanilla to some folks. It took me a while to even gain comfort talking about the faith in that type of way. But that was part of the fruit and inspiration of World Youth Day was also being strengthened and being more fully formed and understanding that, yes, the Holy Scriptures talk about, Jesus himself talked about so frequently, believing with the heart and loving with the heart and the fullness of the heart. I almost sometimes say, I feel like before World Youth Day, maybe I was on a trajectory that was more Thomistic, heavy with the head and the intellect. And then I feel like St. Bonaventure and St. Francis kind of entered into my spiritual life. There was more feeling with the heart.
The heart, obviously, the word heart, like the word love, has been adopted by the modern sort of Hallmark culture and reduced, but it's one of the most commonly used words in the Bible.
Absolutely.
And the Catechism says the heart is the center of our being, where all our powers are integrated. And holiness, if anything, can be defined as perfect integration of the human person and all of his powers integrated towards the proper end. Not rather Thomistic, but I mean, Thomas, obviously you can get too heady about it. But yes, all of our powers, our passions, our feelings, our loves, our desires, our actions have to be integrated. And I would say, yeah, the purpose of evangelization is ultimately that, to make people holy. And people are going to be holy each in their own way. Like there's obviously an objective element to holiness, with the moral law and the church, but there's also a subjective element to it that each person has to integrate that in their own way according to their own path and vocation. And that's what I think JP2 and even indirectly in his own way Pope Francis can teach us. I mean, as I said, Pope Francis is a different kettle of fish, but if we work at it, everything God sends can work to the good.
I had the good fortune of participating in one of the major events in World Youth Day in Toronto, which was the Stations of the Cross through downtown. It was a procession through the downtown core. Beautiful production. I just remember, you know, being in the procession, carrying a torch next to the cross and passing these major institutions in downtown Toronto, including the legislature. That Toronto is the seat of government for the province of Ontario. And I remember at that time, at that age, and in all of the ensuing years, just thinking what a sanctifying moment that was for my hometown. And that's a very gratifying memory of World Youth Day from 2002 in Toronto. I mean, we're coming up on the 20th anniversary of World Youth Day in Toronto. Mm-hmm. And my goodness, the prospect of a similar type of event happening in Canada's biggest city, that would just be a very different experience 20 years later. And I even wonder, could you even pull that off? Just having the buy-in from the local population for that type of thing to happen, who knows if you would get a permit from the authorities. Since the most recent papal visit in 2002 and leading up to now with the impending papal visit, how do you feel Canada has changed, and how do you feel the church in Canada has changed?
So first, to your first point about the procession and whatnot, and the church is a sacramental church, and the sacraments were primarily ex opere operato. That means that they're Christ's work, right? So it doesn't matter how holy the priest is. The grace flows through the priest, whoever it might be, or the ministry, or even outside of the sacraments, the sacramentals, like Stations of the Cross or blessings or whatever. And they flow through, and they produce their effect in a way that's mysterious, that we don't often see right away. So yes, Canada's changed. Obviously, in some ways, it's gotten much worse in some external sense. Like, we're more embedded in the culture of death. Faith has been lost. Mass attendance has gone down. I was talking to one of my students who said that mass attendance in Vancouver Diocese dropped by 44% since COVID. That's incredible. So, yeah, and we look around in a visible way. You say it's all falling to pieces. And, you know, Newfoundland selling all the churches and just like things are just what's left. So at one level, a natural level, you could just lose hope. But the church is not a natural entity, of course. And oftentimes when things seem bleakest, that's when God works the most. And even in our souls, right, you say that, oh, you don't have to feel good to be holy. Oftentimes God works when we feel the worst and we feel in the dumps or whatever and discouraged. That's when grace can often work the most. So yes, could you pull off a big procession, the Stations of the Cross in Toronto? I don't know. Like, would they even allow it nowadays? Would there even be somebody to spearhead it? It's an intriguing question. But I would say that it's not so much about the external pomp and circumstances. That was what was given in 2002. What's given now? I don't know. I mean, one Benedict Labra, St. Benedict Labra, walking through Toronto all by himself, hidden, unseen, could produce as much grace as that huge Stations of the Cross. There's this paradoxical aspect of Catholicism. And there's a phrase in Vatican II about contemplative orders that always struck me. And it's in the section on missionary life, the document of missionary. And it says that before you send in missionaries, the church is sent in contemplative orders to prepare the way. And there's a phrase that says that the evangelization will be as effective as it is hidden. And I always think, wow, that's kind of odd. You always think that event should be very public and you're doing all sorts of public things and these, but no, really it's this hidden thing. And then that leads to the more public manifestation. So I would say perhaps we're entering a realm of history, of the church's history, the trajectory, where it's the hidden saints in some ways, the families, yourself, you know, raising children, struggling, going to mass, doing your family rosary. Those are all very powerful sacramental missions that could, and they're, as you say, they're a fruit of the big public thing of World Youth Day with a million young people milling around Toronto and all this. Yeah, and that was given to us. And the same way I look at what JP2 and Pope Benedict gave us in terms of their teaching, that I see that as a bulwark against what's to come. So we were given a whole breadth of clear, precise teaching, JP2, Pope Benedict. And I'm always a bit discouraged when I see how many people haven't read it. And I say, pick it up, read it. And it's the antidote to the confusion and the ambiguity that we're living through now. It gives you this the capacity to see through it intellectually, but also the devotional life, Mass, Eucharist, the daily bread of life, it gives us the strength to live through it. I would love to see a huge Eucharistic procession through Toronto. I mean, that Eucharistic Revival Congress, I should say, 2008 in Quebec City on the 400th anniversary of the founding of Quebec City. Could we have something like that again? Yeah, there's no reason why not. But it begins with small things.
You mentioned in your response just now a reference to Vatican II. Something which arguably has not changed in the last 20 years is the church's struggle with the implementation of Vatican II. In the same way, around the time of World Youth Day in 2002, there were differing schools of thought on what the Council Fathers intended, what the Council documents mean. In some ways, we're having the same or very similar debate 2022, arguably to an even more intense or elevated level. Do you think coming to terms or really wrapping our arms around the true intent, the true scope, the purpose and the objectives of Vatican II, is that one of the defining struggles and challenges and perhaps opportunities for the church in the modern times?
It is certainly one of the primary controversies in the church nowadays. And it's not so much the intention of Vatican II, because a council doesn't really have an intention per se. I mean, certainly the bishops at the council had intentions. But the primary aspect of any council or any teaching of the church is the text itself. And so we have to go back to the text. And the only way we can interpret a text in the church's teaching is to see that text in context. So the word intention can be, certainly it's being used analogously here, because the intention is often the intention of Christ. So the only intention that really matters at the end of the day is Christ's intention. What does Christ mean from the council? And Christ's intention is interpreted through the lived and living experience of the church. So there are 20 other councils in the church's history, particularly the Council of Trent, all the way back to the Council of Nicaea. And then there's all the other magisterial teaching. And so as Pope Benedict says in his famous 2005 Christmas address, we have to interpret the council in what he calls the hermeneutic of continuity. That's why it's even odd people say they call it the council, because it's only the council in the sense of the most recent council. But there's many other councils, many other teachings of the church. So the way to read Vatican II, and I recommend people actually read the documents, because they're actually quite conservative, especially when you look at the original Latin. The translations are sometimes less than optimal or felicitous and tendentious in some ways. So the council had as much good to say, and I think I teach a course on Second Vatican Councils coming up. I do think we have to appropriate the council. It's there. It's part of the church teaching to put it into effect, but only in light of the whole church's tradition. And so I've written articles recently about Sacrosanctum Concilium, the council speaking of the liturgy, that the way the Novus Ordo Mass is currently celebrated in many places bears little resemblance to what the council actually said, or even what the bishops of the council wanted. And many of them, even in the early days after the council, said if we had seen what would happen, we wouldn't have voted. We would have made more safeguards or whatever. But that said, there is work to be done to put into the effect, the councils, and taking Vatican II in light of everything else that's been said and done by the church.
You also teach, and you've written on church history, again, trying to maintain a historical perspective. To say that the church has always faced a war from without, from the outside world, that seems a fair statement. I mean, long stretches of church history in terms of persecution from the outside world, a constant struggle against the forces from without, the forces of darkness and the forces of evil. And we're experiencing it in a very distinct way in the 21st century, the assault against the church from the outside. The war within the church, and I don't say that term lightly, it does seem in 2022, in the early 21st century, there's more than just skirmishes and debates happening. I mean, there are real opposed forces within the flock itself engaging in internecine conflict. Is that combination of the onslaught from without and the war from within, is that distinct or set apart in church history? If not, you know, what would you draw us to, and what would you want us to bear in mind for perspective?
I think that's always been in the church. I don't think it's new. I mean, the church, people talk about the days of the apocalypse, whatever. And so the church always taught we're always in the last days, that there is, the apocalypse is always going on. So think of Judas. I mean, Judas right there in the midst of the apostles, and here he was, right? He's also. And then right away, Gnosticism, all the heresies in the early church, the Irenaeus, all the way through to the Arians. I mean, so the Arian crisis was huge, very subtle, because there were the semi-Arians, and who was an Arian, who wasn't an Arian. And then all the way to a modern era with modernism, pseudo-neo-Gnosticism, and then obviously it's becoming more poignant in our day. I would say more that the church is like a sinusoidal curve. Like it goes into eras of more peace and unity, and then the forces of evil reach wax and wane. So God gives us eras of peace to regather our strength, and that gets bigger. So to me, it seems that it's as we approach the end, because there isn't going to be an end to things. There's going to be an end to time and end to history. Now, are we living through that? I don't know. Nobody ever knows that. The only thing we can do is approach it with our own, in our own historical circumstances. And to say that the war exists outside the church, inside the church, but primarily it's inside our own souls.
Right.
And that's where the primary battle has to be won or fought, is our own souls. And then the souls over whom we have responsibility, like our children, we teach students or whatever, insofar as we can help people, guide them, nourish them with truth. So all these other battles, yeah, they're all out there. There's bishops who are wayward and doing odd things and saying really bizarre, even heretical things. And you think, yeah, it's in the church. And it goes back to Paul VI, where he said the smoke of Satan has entered the church, that mysterious phrase he said soon after the council. Yeah, but the smoke of Satan has really always been in the church. Is it becoming more vivid? Perhaps in an external way, I could say. But then you read church history, you think, no, it's been bad before. Is it reaching some conclusion? Maybe. But we have to live in a way that each day is our last, and also as though history is going to continue for hundreds of years in the future. That's what hope is. Hope is anchored in eternity, but it also flows into this life. So we can't be discouraged either for eternity, but also we can't be discouraged in this life. We have to keep going as though things are going to last, and we have to build the kingdom of God here on earth, but also as material for the kingdom of heaven.
And the light of an impending papal visit to our shores, our country, is a good opportunity to ask this question. Do you think there's a unique role for the church in Canada to play in everything that you've just described? I mean, you were talking about unique, specific circumstances. I mean, here in the specific circumstances of our country, is there a niche charism for the church in Canada at this time?
Well, I think certainly, yeah. Like every year in the college, we make a pilgrimage to a martyr shrine. And I take the students to the site of the martyrdom of John de Beauboeuf and Gabriel Lallemand. I think it's one of the holiest places in Canada. And they offered their lives. And John de Beauboeuf said he offered his life. He said he would suffer all the punishments for all the sins. Just put them on him. And if you read the account of his martyrdom, God pretty much did that. And I say that the church in Canada has to, as GP2 said to families, has to become what you are. So the church has much strength, more resources and riches than we're aware of. We just have to gather them and use them. And so what is the church in Canada? Well, it's every individual parish, every individual family, every individual person is one sense the church. So everybody has their role to play in re-evangelizing Canada. And that's not this institutional, so much institutional thing where it's going to be the church, this sort of corporation doing something. It's going to be individual Catholics doing something. Now, as a group, as groups, yeah, as pilgrimages, as this, that, and the other thing, we can all get together, and there's all these little groups springing up that are trying to coalesce, and there is strength in numbers. This also strengthens individual souls. And that is where we have to focus our energy and bring about whatever new evangelization God wills in the days, weeks, months ahead.
As we round out our conversation, I do want to get the benefit of your experience building a small but vibrant community of faith in Barry's Bay, Seat of Wisdom College. Your biography is on the website of the school. We'll make sure to include it in the show notes. But you helped co-found what eventually has become Seat of Wisdom College in the rural Ottawa Valley, the rural outskirts of central eastern Ontario. Speak to that a little bit more and what that experience of building a institution of higher learning dedicated to the splendor of truth and to Holy Mother Church, building it from the ground up, the insights with which that has equipped you and how it forms your approach to all of it.
It's tough to answer that in like a minute or so. I was sort of dragged into it. I never intended to help start a college. So it did start from the ground up. It started as a little study center, a little tutorial group. So my own journey, I sought truth as a young guy, and I went to university thinking with a very idealistic frame of mind. I studied science first, and I thought, okay, I'll study the brain, because I think maybe the brain will give me insight into truth. I didn't know much at all. And I was sort of disillusioned through that, you know, those years of science and whatever. And it was only when I went to the Oratory in Toronto, and I was there for a number of years, 6 years, and I was introduced to the church's truth. You know, all the Aristotle, St. Thomas, fathers of the church. And I thought, where was this? And I thought I had to give this to young people somehow. And when I eventually came up to Madonna House and they were starting a little study group and hopefully starting a college, I thought, well, maybe this is the chance. And I found I did have a little bit of a charism for teaching. And I thought, well, I'll do it for a year. And I did it for a year, and then we were given an old convent to use and books and a library, and we just started teaching, gathering young people, and lo and behold, it's been now 22 years later, and it's developed into a college. Now, what have I learned from that? Well, the truth is the foundation. Now, we can't have the faith without the truth. So for all the other aspects of the faith, it is grounded in truth. And that's why we have to begin with, really, with teaching in some ways, right? That there has to be a sense, not formal teaching that we do up in Barry's Bay, but teaching in some sense. And I see the fruit of that and how much the truth gives to young people and what that produces in their souls, the community, the like-mindedness between them, the friendships that are produced. Now, obviously, the truth is the beginning, and from that flows hope, love, community, friendship, marriages, families, vocations. That's, if I could give you one insight, it's that, if that I, one little thing I've learned is that the truth will set you free is our motto. And to any family out there, any person listening, as Augustine's conversion began, tole et legge, pick up and read. Pick up and read. Now, reading in the broad sense could be reading, listening, whatever, but just learn something about the faith, pick up something, and see the beauty of it, the splendor of truth. And that will lead us. And that the truth guides our decisions. And as we choose for the truth, we will see all the fruit of that. And that primary truth that GP2 emphasized is the truth of faith, right? So all the fruit, but also the truth of the moral life. And as we live the truth of the moral life, our lives become more integrated, more joyful, more happy, and more fulfilled. And I've seen that with all the generations of young people I've taught. And I just see so much good consequences of the little thing that we do up here. And I only wish that people could do it across the country. We're just a small little college up in Barry's Bay, Ontario. There's no reason why this can't be at least done elsewhere and instantiated even in big universities somehow. And just to give what the church has been given from Christ.
Well, John Paul, we're going to quit while we're ahead. That was a beautiful bowl with which to wrap up this conversation. John Paul Meenan, really appreciate your time with us today. And I look forward in the days and the weeks ahead to praying together with you for a fruitful visit from the Holy Father and for many fruits and graces for our church here in Canada, for our Indigenous brothers and sisters, and for the church worldwide. Thank you so much for your time today.
Indeed. Thank you. You're welcome, Patrick. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks for tuning in. If you like what you heard, don't forget to subscribe to our show wherever you get your podcasts and help us to reach more listeners by leaving us a rating or referring us to a friend. If you'd like to partner with us in the delivery of this podcast, head on over to our website at crownandcrozier.com and click the heart button in the top right-hand corner to learn more about making a one-time or monthly donation. We're sincerely grateful for you listening in, and we look forward to providing you with future episodes on church, state, and faithful citizenship. Until then, God bless.